You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, this is Glenn Lowry. I am recording this introduction to my conversation with Michelle Kerr, who is a public school teacher in Fremont, California. This is to be appended to the incomplete video of my conversation with Michelle. Unfortunately, I had a technical glitch at the start, and our conversation will begin right in the middle of her stating a sentence. I try to recover by reintroducing her a few minutes into the video that you'll be seeing. This is the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. Glenn Lowry introducing my conversation with Michelle Kerr, a longtime follower of the Glenn Show and a school teacher in a disadvantaged population school in Fremont, California. Okay.
So, example, algebra one to seniors, which is a much lower level of at-risk kids. So that's my ability is balancing actual math instruction, but also getting kids motivated. I also teach ESL. And in the past, I've taught history. And I'm now teaching engineering. So that's kind of me. So I'm, one of the things if you read my essay, you know, I talked about, that when we're teachers, you have, if you say, I teach kids math, based on what kind of teacher you are, you emphasize a different word of that. So, you know, it's I teach kids math, or I teach kids math, or I teach kids math. I'm definitely the last one. I'm a teacher, capital T. You know, what I teach isn't as important as teachers. We tend to be divas. Mary Hudson, to use a contrast, she teaches kids, capital F, French, okay? Mary Hudson is about teaching French, just to give an example. That, to her, the purpose of her teaching is to instruct kids in French. The third category, when you're in ed school, and it's really funny because they always act like this is very obvious when you're in ed school, and it's not, which is they go, what's the first thing you do if a kid is misbehaving in your class? And the correct answer is supposed to be, you want to know why they're misbehaving. And I'm like, no. My first thing is, stop the kid from misbehaving, because I want my kids to all benefit. You know, one kid misbehaving is out. Within reason. I mean, I'm not a disciplinarian or anything like that. You talk to a subject teacher, they're like, this kid is stopping me from teaching the subject. You are going to get low on the schedule. The correct answer for ed school, which is a very, quote, K orientation, kids, is, why is that kid misbehaving? Yeah. I'm like, no. No offense. I don't care why the kid's behaving. I'm not mad at him. It's not personal, right? But that is a K orientation. You know, in other words, their first thing is they want to help kids. So those are your three kind of areas.
I teach kids math.
Yeah.
I teach kids
math.
I teach kids math. Okay. Let me just interrupt here for a minute, Michelle Kerr. Public school teacher, Title I school, low income, disadvantaged kids, Fremont, California, East Bay. I want to redo the intro just a little bit because I'm not sure on the technical side that I got it on tape.
Okay.
So this will either be redundant or it'll be absolutely necessary. But I am with Michelle Kerr. She has an essay that she proposes be published in the Quillette. I hope the editors are listening and that they are persuaded that it's worthy of gracing their webzine. She's reacting to a certain degree to reflections of another public school teacher, retired now, Mary Hudson, who has been a guest at the Glenn Show in the past and who has her own essay in Quillette magazine reflecting on the difficulties of teaching disadvantaged kids. Michelle is a longtime viewer of the Glenn Show, and she and I have been in correspondence online about these ideas, and I'm giving her an opportunity to express them here because I think we'll all be edified by that. So, okay.
What I want to say is just there's an age difference to this. In other words, in elementary school, you're much more likely to be a K. You know, you teach kids. Or maybe move into your level at college, it's all subject. You know, I mean, it's in fact, teaching at the college level is largely, I don't want to say entirely, but, you know, being a good teacher isn't as good as being a good publisher. So you're much more about the subject.
Yeah, well, let me give my own reflection on this because I think the distinction is conceptually interesting that you can put the emphasis on the subject. Of course, I'm a teacher of people in doctoral studies in economics, and therefore, of course, if the emphasis is on the subject, you could put the emphasis on, I almost want to say, a kind of therapeutic or supportive relationship with the child, where maybe you're surrogate parenting or something like that, or you're a little social worker surrogate or something like that.
Right.
Or you could put the emphasis on the pedagogic goal of teaching. I assume that that means informed by the requirements of being effective at that pedagogic role in the circumstance where you're dealing with kids who may be burdened by economic disadvantage, by disorder in their home life, by peer influences that are deleterious, and all of that.
Put another way, all teachers care about the T, the K, and the subject. All of them do. The issue is where they orient. So, in other words, you know, what part do you kind of focus on first? So, you know, and that makes a difference. The reason I mention that is because in high school, particularly today, and I'm saying going back, say, 10, 15 years, as we have increasingly put demands, academic demands on high school, which means that teachers really are dealing with, particularly in low-income schools, are dealing with kids who aren't always ready for the subject material. And in teaching, one of the buzzwords is will and skill. So a student can be low skilled but try to learn. Student can be low skilled but not interested in learning. You occasionally get high skilled, not interested in learning. They're rarely a huge problem, but it does happen. So what I'm saying is that when you couple these two things, the teacher orientation with the kids in high poverty schools, you then start to run into stories like Mary Hudson's. Because, well, I think any orientation you can make work. In other words, any particular teacher can figure out a way to work in a school with at-risk kids who don't really want to be there or aren't really prepared to be there and make it work. But when you read something like Mary Hudson, it's like, no, she was all about teaching French. She walks in the first day to class to a, you know, high poverty African-American school and starts speaking French. And it went downhill from there. Whereas for me, if you said, no, I don't teach French and I don't want to, I speak a little bit, but I'm not a language person. If you told me I was going to do that, I would go in and say, you know, you might want to go to Haiti someday. You know, you might want to go to West Congo someday. You might want to be a social worker and work in the West Congo and help people, right? And then I'd say, they go, well, I don't know where Haiti is. And I go, oh, let's talk about Haiti. And I might eventually get around to teaching French, you know. But to me, the purpose would be they're sitting there, they're learning something, and that's a step ahead. And, you know, slowly introduce French. And, of course, the more I did it, the more I would start to figure out ways to get French, the language, in sooner. You know what I'm saying? Whereas a K teacher might not ever, and I know a lot of language teachers, not at this school, thank God, but at others, where they do very little language teaching. You know what I'm saying? They're all K all the way. But just to show you, so when I read that, it was like yet another story come from one particular segment, which is inner city, low-income African-Americans. When you hear the quote, you know, the kids didn't care, they were awful, they, you know, Ed Bolin, who wrote a book called
Hold on, there's too much information, I think. I'm only cutting you off so that we can put this in a progressive kind of thing. I really, really, really want to hear from you. But you know how I do at the Glenn Show. I like to try to summarize and keep track of where the
you do it very well.
Because I'm hearing some very interesting stuff. I mean, I'm hearing, you know, the kids are not all in the same place and we have to meet them where they are. And I'm hearing disadvantaged kids are disadvantaged. Duh. They are disadvantaged. And therefore, even if they have the will, they may not have the skill, whatever the skill is, to tackle whatever the subject matter might be. And I'm hearing that whereas the profile that the kids are bringing into the classroom is relevant and the attitude that the teachers bring is relevant, what's really important is that those two things be coordinated with one another, that the teacher's pedagogic approach has to be well adapted to where the kids are and what they're capable of doing. So if you put the emphasis on teaching, which is, it sounds to me almost like a kind of a middle ground somehow between being completely in a therapeutic posture where you're trying to minister to the kid but not necessarily trying to educate them versus being on some high plateau somewhere where you're writing equations on the blackboard that nobody has any idea what they mean, and you're mad at them because they don't know what you're writing on the blackboard. They're stupid or they're lazy or whatever.
Well, it doesn't even have to be that bad. But yeah, I mean, I'm just saying it doesn't have to be that you're thinking that. It's just that that's your focus. Yes.
Okay. And you want to teach. You want to teach kids by meeting them where they are. Well, can you give you had a beautiful example in something of yours that I read. It might not have been the draft for the Quillette piece. It might have been something else I clicked on, where you were talking about teaching this kid how to solve these little math puzzles.
Yes.
By drawing circles on a piece of paper.
Yes. Like yes.
That was beautiful.
Yes.
Mary, share that with us.
That was a story I wrote for with a terrible title called Higher Standards in Santino, but it was my second year of teaching, and it was all Algebra 1 that year. That was the last year I taught Algebra 1. I still get minor post-traumatic flashbacks from teaching. If somebody said, hey, go teach Algebra 1, I'm like, nah! and it was because the range of abilities was so huge. You had some bright and shiny freshmen who wanted to be there, some bright and shiny freshmen who didn't. You had seniors that were just trying to figure this out. You had kids who were just waiting to go to alternative school, the whole thing.
How many kids in this classroom?
Oh, well, I taught five classes, and they all were 30 and higher. So it was a big class. Yeah, my classes. But again, I'm a diva. When you have, Michelle, I want you to teach six kids. I'm like, well, that's a small house, man. I don't know. And I had been, and the point, and I tried to make this clear in the story, that I had explained ratios 8 billion times in every different way I could think of. And I walked by Santino, as I called him in the story, and his test was blank, and it was always blank. And there was a ratio problem. It was, Mary was baking pies, and she baked three pies for every one, apple pies for every one pumpkin, right? And I just randomly, it's like, this kid always turned an utterly blank test. It had his name and nothing else. And so I drew three circles labeled A and then one P, and then I walked away. And I came back, and he had finished it and solved the problem and written it down. So we went down to the next one. That was the first time I was able to, break through to him.
Yeah, I think the problem was, if she baked 24 pies altogether, yes, how many apple pies did she
exactly bake? And he had drew them all out. Yeah. And what's funny is I had that student, and through him, the beginning of the story, which was really funny, because I then had him his next year in geometry, which he only passed geometry because I came up with this modified curriculum that I said, if you do this modified to a bunch of the kids in the class, if you do this modified curriculum, I will give you a D and you will get a passing score and be able to go on. And of the 20 kids I offered it to, 10 took it. Ten took it and got the D. Two of them did better than that once I modified it and ended up getting a C. So he was now in my geometry class, where he was doing well. He was working the same curriculum. He was getting a D, but he was writing on the paper. It was a step up. And the principal came in, or the AVP came in, and said, hey, I want to check in. How's Santino doing? And I said, oh, he's doing great. And she goes, he's got a D. We must have some different definition of great. And she walked out. And I'm like, I was happy, and it was, and he graduated on time. And one of the things I said was that he would never have graduated on time without me for those two periods, because I don't think anybody else would have passed him. And I don't mean that in the teacher is here. I mean that in a practical
sense. I think it should be mentioned. He was an older kid, right? He was a migrant kid.
He was a migrant. And what's really interesting is he had quite good English. He was categorized as a migrant worker kid, but his English was quite good. He just rarely used it. I think our longest conversation ever was the first time he took, at the time California had the CAESE, which was a graduation exam, and I had put together a prep for my sophomores. And keep in mind, algebra as a freshman class at the time was technically behind in California. So to be an algebra in your sophomore year, which means you had failed it three times, two times, this would be your third time through. But the longest conversation we had was he came. I said, he got a 348 and passing was a 350. And I could not believe how well he did. I was like, I am thrilled. And he goes, I did not know the geometry. I will learn that next time. It was so cute because he had me for geometry and then he passed it. So yeah, it was as a junior. It was really exciting.
Okay. Let me ask you this. So as one of Mary Hudson's complaints, she's not here to speak for herself, but she did get an hour at the Glenn Show. And we talked at length about her experiences, was that there was just so much chaos and disorder in the classroom. It was just kids were, irreverent. They weren't disinterested. They were disruptive. And that she didn't get support from the school system in her effort, including physical intimidation and whatnot, to deal with kids, that the system would always take the side of the kids. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but this is what I remember her saying. And I don't know, it seems like you take exception to that. I mean,
No, let me clarify. I think I believe her. And my point is that when you read that, you feel that, oh my God, the schools must be horrible. They're in chaos. But in fact, as I talked earlier about will and skill. If you have a school filled with kids, public school filled with kids with zero will or very low will, they don't want to be there.
They don't want to be there.
And Mary was exactly right when she said, and everybody's got it, there are kids who treat school if that's their social life. That's absolutely true. So I did not, that's actually what made it frustrating, was it was clear that she was accurately describing things about that. It was a kind of more where she put the blame that I disagree with. But what I'm saying is I think it's quite true that there are schools, probably predominantly in inner city schools, heavily African American, where they juke the stats. You know, in other words, that, you know, she gave a kid an F and they changed it. The kids didn't show up and they marked them present. You hear about it all right. The time. Oakland used to have trouble. Oakland's not nearly as African American as it used to be. It's only about 30% now. But at the height of West Richmond, I'm sure has that. You've heard there was a big fuss in the Washington, D.C. system about there was kids getting diplomas who'd only showed up like 30% of the time. So I completely believed her about
that. So that's just corruption, isn't it? I mean, they're doing that in order to make the records look good so they don't get disciplined for malperformance?
Yes, I think that's it. I wanted to say something. I would not work in a school like that, and I sympathize with her on that point. I'm just saying my thing would have been different. My thing would have been, you know, not, oh, my God, the entire public education system wrong. You know what I'm saying? It's like, no, I don't apply at schools in very – and here's why. Because I think to teach them well takes a K orientation, and I'm a T, baby. You know what I mean? In other words, but what I want – that I think that people don't realize when I read stuff like that, even though she mentioned it in passing, was that there are people every single day who successfully go in and take those chaotic schools and turn, you know, to a chaotic classroom and turn them into something manageable. Now, they might not have great test scores. They might not have everything else, but it is a functioning classroom. And how you turn low-will kids into just low-skill kids who are willing to work is what those schools need. The problem is, the pressure to get high scores. So for example, you know, every day, and when I've taught English before, you have kids who are reading at the sixth grade level in your class and you're giving them, you know, Antigone and saying, not only do I want you to read Antigone, but then I want you to write an essay on it. And it's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like that's not what that kid needs. And you get that a great deal. And
I see.
And what I'm saying is that the schools are in this impossible position between they'll get fired or get in trouble, or the school will get money denied or 8 million other things if they don't do what they're, you know, if they don't have a certain level. At the same time, on the other side, they have teachers. And of course, if someone like me is going to go, and by the way, I would, except for the discipline issue. I mean, I got in trouble at my second school, the one with the Santino story. Not in trouble, it's too strong a word, but I was under constant pressure that I was sending too many kids out of the room. And it wasn't that many. I'm talking maybe three a week, okay? But I was under tremendous pressure on that point from my principal. The kids, on the other hand, were meanwhile telling me, you aren't throwing enough kids out. You know what I mean? There's still kids who are goofing around. And
well,
by the way,
what happened to the kids who were thrown out just on
they
that?
They just go to the principal's office. Nothing bad. I'm always like, you can come back the next day. I'm not trying. I'm just like, you know, you won't shut up or whatever. But my point is that this is, I felt that tension and I stood up to it. And by the way, towards the end, a lot of the kids who got thrown out, I successfully managed to teach. Others moved to alternative school. You know, I mean, it smooths out over the year, but you have to be willing as a teacher. And by the way, that is the single biggest thing that new teachers get in trouble for is kicking too many kids out. So when I say I disagree with Mary Hudson's piece, it was her conclusions. I totally agree with what, I mean, I believe her.
Okay. Let me ask you this. So what has race got to do with it? I somehow detected, again, I don't want to put words in Mary's mouth, but we talked at some length, she and I. And I had the feeling that she was, that these minority kids, these black kids that she was encountering in the high schools in New York City, had a chip on their shoulder about her being a white woman. You're a white woman, if I may say so, at least so you appear to be.
I'm there's not a single cell in my body west of, I think, Alsace, Germany, or France, or whatever Alsace is part of. Yes, I'm defiantly Celtic.
Okay, so how do you relate across the racial line with the kids? Do racial attitudes that the kids bring into the school impair their learning? Do you think that you're more or less effective? I don't want to, you know,
no, I say,
offend
I think,
you, but I'm interested off, in your perspective.
No, I'm first off, race matters in a sense, but what I would say is that in the inner cities of in many inner cities, you have multi-generational poverty, welfare. You know what I mean? There's like no real sense of an outside world. This is me speaking from what I'm hearing and reading. This is one area I don't have a lot of.
The kid has no real sense of what the larger world is like.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
And okay. No real belief in that outside world. I believe you would get a similar thing from the poor whites in Boston. You know, I mean, yeah. I don't know if they even exist there anymore, you know, but it's a cultural. It's
well, they exist somewhere. They exist in eastern Kentucky and southwestern Ohio and so forth.
Yeah, but you know what? Rural, for example, you rarely hear horror stories about teaching rural African Americans. You know what I'm saying? It's not, you know what I'm saying? It's not, you don't hear those stories. It's definitely something that seems linked to that. And I think it's a tough crowd. Likewise, you know, you hear horror stories about the parents being corrupt and, you know, the kids not having good skills, but you don't hear that kind of attitudinal stuff that really seems an inner city thing. Sometimes Hispanics, LA, I hear tough things about Hispanics. The Bay Area is unique in that we have a lot of suburban poverty. And when you're in suburban poverty, you got rich people all around you, especially in the Bay Area. And I always joke that they're kind of institutionalized. They're a little more, you know, they're a little more willing to buy into the story that if they dot their I's and cross their T's, they might get out there into the big bad world and make something of themselves. And so they also often go to school with kids who are not, we have more economic diversity. So for example, my previous school, Willow Glen, was 70% Hispanic. 70% poverty, but the other 30% were white, mostly some African American, who lived in San Jose, California. They were not poor. Okay, so you have a lot more. I teach now in Fremont. Our school is genuinely diverse. We're about 35, 25, 10, which is Asian, Hispanic, white, and black. It's you rarely get that level of genuine diversity. Most people, when they say diversity, they mean there's a majority race and it's not white, but we're genuinely diverse.
So both whites and blacks are a minority.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Both white. Well, there are very few majority white high schools in the Bay Area.
Okay. So let me ask you this.
Did that answer your question, or did you see what I was saying about how race, that I think what was hitting Mary was more the cultural disbelief of, and the unwillingness to buy in. And
that is right. Thing,
I do think that, again, this is hypothesis, not anything I have, that in that environment, the kids like that, absolutely, before anything, going back to the ed schools were right, before anything, they need evidence that you, the teacher, care about them, that might be something they need. This would also explain one other thing.
Are they going to believe you, or are they going to believe her no matter what she does?
There's plenty of stories of whites succeeding in that environment. There, I mean, remember the New York City, I mean, say what you will, the New York City school system is, I think, 25% African American, and a lot of the schools are functional and not just the charter schools. You know what I mean? So I believe that there are, that's what I tried, what I was getting at is that, you know, she made it sound like that's everywhere. And as opposed to, there's a lot of teachers every day making it work in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, everywhere else.
Do you think, where are you on standardized testing? Do you think that we should pay attention to the test scores and lament the fact that they're so low for minority kids in urban school systems? And whose fault is that, if that's a problem?
Well, fault?
Maybe that's not a useful question.
Yeah, well, no. I believe in standardized tests? Yes. In fact, I'm very concerned that colleges are stopping using standardized tests, that there's a move to do that. I find it extremely concerning. Because one of my major concerns is that colleges are just eliminating any notion of a standard to get into college. And that's very concerning to me. So I'm a big believer in standardized tests. I would like to see, again, if you look at a high school test, not so much in California these days. California's gone to one test their junior year. But I want the test to be ones that the kids sit down and they try it and it like, oh yeah, I can do this problem. Oh, I can do this next one. That one, you know, to engage them. And a lot of times the expectations going back to this belief, the belief is that everybody can achieve at the same level. And that if they can't achieve at that level, forget it. I'm not going to take a position on whether everybody can achieve at the same level. Well, no, I will take a position. Not everybody can achieve at the same level. So the question is, though, is that I don't think there would be a problem in our society with the statement that not everybody can achieve at the same level were it not for the fact that there's a distressing racial, you know, predictive level to where everybody is. That's the problem. And school is defined by the racial achievement gap. Everything we do is trying to change that. So
I got to stop you. I got to pause for a minute. I think this is so important. First of all, you're worried about colleges abandoning scrutiny of standards and when they're making admissions decisions, and the trend toward not the relying on test scores for college admissions troubles you. And I see that as being very well connected to with what you just said about believing that everyone cannot achieve at the same level, and recognizing that acting on that belief will then render vivid and apparent the racial disparity in the levels at which people are achieving, racial achievement gap and so on. And I was talking with someone here at the Glenn Show a few weeks ago, Amy Wax, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
I watched it, yeah.
And we were talking about this, and this issue of kind of flattening out assessment in order not to expose differential development. That's how I'm going to phrase
yes.
it. You know, the grade, okay, if somebody's getting an A and somebody's getting a C, the reason that we have this differentiation presumably is to inform ourselves and the students about what is possible, what they've achieved, where they stand, what needs to be done. It's this kind of feedback. You're assessing people because there is gradations in performance. On the other hand, and with reason, people are reluctant to trumpet huge racial gaps. First of all, it promotes this insidious belief that the blacks are genetically inferior or whatever. Secondly, maybe it kind of blames the victim, you know, it puts it on the kids or the kids' parents or whatever that they're backward behind and you know, and so then we kind of not to make a judgment. And I will say from my own account as an economist, but also just as a reflective African-American, I think that's a disaster. I think it's a disaster to not take seriously the disparities that are there for fear that it's going to either hurt feelings or that it somehow makes one racist for calling attention to these things. But I do think the key is that you don't kind of derogate and denigrate the worth of the kid because of this. You recognize this as a challenge, and you try to find a way of meeting it. I don't know, something like that. I'm not sure exactly how to put it, but so you say the achievement gap is everything. Do you think it gets too much focus? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm blessed at a school, and we've gone through two principles where we're not given a lot of pressure on test scores, which is very nice. Okay. In other words, we're, for example, in our school, the military comes and makes pitches. We are perfectly happy if a kid wants to go into the military. We encourage, there's some kids, there's a trade, you know, they get a connection into the union and go into trade school. We're very good on that point. So I have not personally struggled with that much. But what I would say is this, is I would go twofold. One, there is no such thing as an absolute meritocracy. I do tend to agree with that. Let me give you an example. We have, you talk about this too, in the New York specialized schools, we have a dominance of Asian Americans, Asian immigrants, who are doing much, much, much better on test scores. It's getting far more competitive to get into all of the universities, right? And as everybody knows, if you just took test scores, most of them would be, the Asians are already disproportionately represented. I haven't seen, and I never know how to say this without sounding snarky, and I don't mean it snarky. I have not seen a corresponding massive blast of improved achievement. You know what I mean? We're not seeing, you know, we're not getting to the moon. We're not, you know what I'm saying? It's like the average graduate coming out is not, in my mind, of even Harvard, more impressive. They're just more Asian. And so it's like we've, you know, does that make sense? In other words, we're just...
Well, let me make sure I know what you're saying. The Asians are getting higher test scores than everybody else and therefore getting into some of these elite schools at a higher rate. But at the end of the day, they're not necessarily better engineers, writers, lawyers, physicians than anybody else. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, and I'm saying, I mean, and I you know, it's like so... So those are issues that I don't know how you resolve, but it's like I want to give a nod to those issues. I am not a test score purist. Mm-hmm. I believe that, I mean, and I did not believe this 10 years ago before I became a teacher, and it's not been something I just jumped to as a teacher. But I'm now at the point where if we set a particular standard, let's say comfort with Algebra 2 level math, that is polynomials, factoring, transformation, you know what I mean? Algebra 2 and higher. 10th grade reading level, which is something to aspire to.
Yeah.
You know, corresponding like some reasonable level that right now is not achieved by most kids. That you could basically do a lottery. And if not a lottery for private schools because you don't want to make them, I'm definitely at the point of saying our public schools should be focused purely on taking only public universities should only be taking kids at that level. That's it. In other words, if Harvard wants to take on, you know, 10 basketball players with SAT scores in the 300s, and if they also want to, you know, take, you know, 5,000, I'm kidding, they don't take 5,000, but a bunch of Chinese, literally Chinese nationals who probably cook the books, that's up to them. But in our public universities, they need to have a standard. But what's happening instead is our public universities feel they're very K, trust me. And they're very dedicated to getting in people who can't do the work. And we're in the process of destroying a college degree, diploma, the value of it, just utterly obliterating it to the point that the only thing that will matter is which school you went to, because they'll be able to kind of judge, or which major you have, so they'll be able to kind of judge what it is. That, to me, is tremendously troubling.
And this is so interesting, Mary. Let me just interrupt you for a minute, Michelle.
Yeah, it's okay.
So your standard is so modest. Algebra 2 in a 10th grade reading level. I mean, that ain't asking a whole lot, okay?
Thank you.
Somebody who's getting ready
exactly.
to go to college.
Yes.
We're about to destroy the value of a degree because the standard setting has become so lax. And then at the end of the day, all that'll matter is the warm glow kind of prestige value or brand value of the college that you go to, because college in and of itself won't be telling you that much.
Do you know what the Cal State University system has done, right? Have you heard this?
No.
Not just Cal. It's Cal, Tennessee, and I forget the other state right now. They have eliminated remediation. Now, remediation with what you did is you accept somebody in. That doesn't mean what you might think it means. They accept somebody in, and they say, okay, you're not ready. Your test doesn't show it. So we're going to give you a year to get up to level. And in that year, you will pay tuition, and you'll be at but you won't get credit for those courses. They won't be college-bearing. At the end of the year, if you're ready, you can go on. If you're not, you'll have to go back to community college and get ready. They've been doing this for 20, 30 years. They just stopped. And what we mean by it is they're now going to say, hey, you're not ready for math, but come on in anyway, and we'll give you college-level courses, and we will give you credit for taking, you know, remedial math courses.
Why is this happening? Because no one wants to, the overrepresentation of minorities amongst the remedial students?
Yeah, and they are pointing to a bunch of test scores of results that show that if you look at just up above and below the cut score for remediation,
yeah.
that there's not a big difference. And so the thing is that we're now, so they that standard, and by the way, that standard had already lowered what teachers were doing at the college level. You know, they're already dumbing things down because, you know, if you're a professor, you get in trouble if you're failing too many, not professor, but an instructor, you know, not an adjunct. You get, yeah. you're gonna get pressure if you don't pass them all. So that was already happening, but at least they had a minimum you had to go by, and they've just wiped it out. And the professors at the university protested it was done against their will. I find this very, very worrisome.
Where are you on discipline and suspensions? You say you have kids removed from your classroom, but you let them back the next day or whatever.
Well, I always would, yeah. I mean, but no, disciplines and suspensions, discipline is one thing. I mean, first off, I should say that year that I taught algebra was my second year, and I've gotten better. I rarely throw kids out at all. And when I do, it's often for very minor things. I have one rule. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you do what I tell you. So, for example, if a kid's eating my class, and we have rat problems. So when I say don't eat in my class, I'm not saying that's some petty tyrannic rule. It's like, I don't want rats in my freaking classroom, okay? So a kid will be eating, and I'll say, hand it over, and they stuff it in their mouth. I call a supervisor and say, go. And they're like, why? Like, because you didn't listen to what I said, okay? And you're always like, so my rules, I always say at the end of the day, it's like, you can be rude to me. One of my rules is not you can't be rude to me. I'm okay with that. But if I say do something, it's like, you know, I need that kind of, you know, give me your phone if you're using your phone. Do this, do that. And it's pretty good, and I'm not a tyrant. But every teacher, and I read this many times before I became a teacher, if you have trouble in your classroom, it's probably two or three kids. And it's very easy to get to the point that you think it's everybody. You know what I mean? It's very easy to think, oh, my God. But it's two or three kids, and they're sucking in three or four more kids each, you know. And if you're looking at systemic behavior, and by the way, a couple years I taught U.S. history. I love teaching U.S. history. But I had two kids one was quite bright, one was not, but they would not shut up. They would not shut up. And it was such a reminder, this is what it's like when you're teaching the whole random sample of the whole student body as opposed to Algebra 2, where you're only teaching the kids who have crossed their I's and dotted their T's enough to get into Algebra 2, you know. And it was very humbling to me. We had a good relationship, and I got through, but it was tough. So I would not, you can't throw out a kid every day. I mean, you just can't. And so if you find yourself doing it, you really have to think of other things to do. And it's very hard. And that's when you've only got one or two. When you have a bunch, I believe, and I've said so, and when I'm training new teachers, I say, if a kid is giving you trouble, throw them out. Throw them out right away. Not with any malice. You know, when I say throw them out, that is a process. You call the supervisor, they come remove the kid. It's not like, you know, kid, be gone from my classroom. It's a process. But I'm like, until you get control, you have to have control. You have to know what it feels like to have kids do what you say. You know what I'm saying? And if you can't get that, then you need to start removing a kid until you get that sense, and that should be supported. And by the way, most principals will support that. If they don't, it's because they're in a school like Mary Hudson's, where if they did that, there'd be 50 kids down there every day, and it's out of control. But suspension rates, we work hard at our school not to have bad suspension rates. And one of the reasons I believe that we're able to do that is because they hire teachers who are either T or K, as well as some, you know, they hire some academic teachers as well, but they do make sure that they're looking for teachers that are not looking for perfection, that are looking for engagement and investment and helping a kid move the needle. And that's what they look for. And if you get that, you can do more of it. The suspension issue, larger, one last thing. It's really about discipline. And if you look at the discipline rates and the suspension rates, and see them, you really need to know what were they for. And schools are under tremendous pressure to have racially balanced. I mean, you know what I'm saying? They're under tremendous pressure. There are very, very few schools that are just saying, ah, who cares? The kid didn't have a pencil, throw him out. Because we're under such pressure. So the suspension rate that exists in public non-charter schools is a suspension rate that exists despite their incredible awareness of the pressure they're under. Wow. So I just ask you to keep that in mind.
Well, I want to ask you a question because I've been talking about this for a while. Following the debate that arose after the President Obama's Department of Education sent a letter around to local districts calling their attention to racial disparities and suspension rates and basically, you know, kind of threatening that there could be some problems with civil rights litigation if they didn't get those numbers more in balance. And then the Trump Education Department, Betsy DeVos, apparently backing away from that policy and people saying that that's the wrong thing. And obviously, I'm no expert in education, and I wonder what you think. But the thought in my mind about this was, well, you know, if school districts really are discriminating against the black kids, the black men in particular, by same behavior exhibited by them talking back to the teacher, having a cell phone, eating in the classroom, whatever it might be, leading to suspension if they're black, but not if they're white. Well, that would clearly be a problem. Differential treatment, unfair treatment. That would be a problem. That's discrimination. The Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education ought to be interested in stamping that out. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I thought, suppose, however, that maybe because of culture and, you know, social circumstances, family life, you know, community organization or whatnot, on average, not everyone, black kids are coming in with more behavioral issues that are leading to them getting suspended. That doesn't make them bad. I'm not trying to blame them, but just say that's the case. I don't know if it's the case or not, but if it's the case, then putting pressure on school districts to eliminate the racial gap in the suspension is maybe not the best policy because it fails to actually address itself to the underlying behavioral difference, which is not discrimination and not unlawful, but which is something that ought to attract the attention of educators because it's part of the educational mission. And I'm stimulated even more to think in this direction when I realized that it might have implications for what kind of teacher I want to have in the classroom with the students.
Yes.
I want a K teacher more than I want a M teacher in the classroom with the students, kind of thing like that. So can we deal with the real problems and address ourselves to them, or are we going to be all about optics and the superficial headcount kind of thing and whatever? That's what I thought, and I wonder what you think.
No, that's exactly right. And anecdotally, that's exactly what happened. And it's particularly difficult in my particular school had no issue with it, but it's particularly difficult in schools with high diversity. In other words, if you have a school that's 90% African American, you're not under pressure to stop suspending black kids. If you have a school that is 30% black and 70% white, you're under tremendous pressure. Or if you're in LA, which has schools like that, which are Hispanic and white, you're facing tremendous pressure because at the same time, you've also got to worry about the white parents who are going to pick up and leave and the Asian parents who are going to pick up and leave if the classrooms get too out of control. So you're under attendance pressure on one sense and you're under, you know, and what happened was that the classes did, there was anecdotally stories all in the newspaper from all these different areas about teachers going, they would just send the kid back. You know what I mean? It's like, they would just send the kid right back and we weren't able to kick kids out of the classroom and there were complaints. So they put it this way. You didn't hear the union complaining too much, the big wigs at the union complaining too much when Trump rolled back Betsy rolled back the thing. You know, you didn't have them going, oh no, you don't hear a lot about that. That's because it was an issue.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. No, look, again, you gotta kind of remember that, teachers are, we're about 2-1 Democrat to Republican, consistent.
Right.
But it's a liberal crew. And not only that, you generally don't go into teaching unless you like kids. I mean, this is really truthfully the case. You know, everybody's got their horror story teacher one way or another. But most of them like kids. Most of them aren't out to cause trouble. However, funny story. When I was back at Willow Glen, which was my second school, Debbie Dean, hi, Debbie, if you're out there somewhere. Debbie Dean she's as opposite of me as you could get in that Debbie, if it was day 42, Debbie could tell you what she was teaching that day. Whereas I'm like, I know what I do what I'm teaching tomorrow, right? You know what I mean? Completely different. Very methodical, very not stolid, not stoic, but, what's the word I want? Impassive, very, very low key, emotional range from here to here. Whereas I'm like this, you know, I'm like, She came to me one day, and she was a senior teacher, and this was only my second year. She came in and, I had a bad day today. And I said, you did? What happened? She goes, a kid told me to my face, that kid said, pardon the friend, fuck you. And I looked at her, and she goes, you know, I had him removed, but I don't think I can have him back. Now, my jaw was down here, because I had kids tell me, F you, 4 times a day. You know, I come from a totally different class of teacher. I'm like, you know, if you don't say F to me sometimes, I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah, you can say it back.
I don't go that far. But yeah, I mean, the point is like, it was really astonishing to me to realize that. And here's the thing. Debbie was the best algebra teacher our school had. She was what's called an algebra specialist. She was Teacher of the Year, I think, the year before. A rock star teacher. Okay. Very, very good. But her discipline, if a kid like said that to her, you know, a kid would be in real trouble despite being this excellent teacher. Whereas me, second year out, I didn't like, you know, kind of went over my head. They had to go further before I would, you know, it's like, I don't care if you say fuck you, will you be quiet? You know what I mean? I was like, that was me. It's like, now that you said it, can you be quiet for like 10 minutes so I can get the, but it also brought up to me the fact that I'll bet it clearly doesn't happen to Debbie that often. And then you start to realize, wow, you know why it doesn't happen? Because Debbie is this like calm presence, you know, whereas me, I'm not. So you start to realize that individual teachers have, you know, inspired different responses from the kids, which aren't necessarily that my kids hate me and you know, things like that. And that's when metrics start to get really hard. You know what I'm saying? Because,
No, go ahead. You're on a roll, but there are a couple other things I wanted to ask.
Keep on going. Yeah, no, that was it. I was just, trying to use it an illustration of how metrics can, you know, so, I'm certain the kid that I don't know what the race of the kid that said that to Debbie was, but I'm just saying that, you know.
So let's talk about metrics a little bit. You're a standards person. You said you believed in tracking. And I'm wondering whether you believe in assessing teachers based upon the metrics that their student performance produce.
No. And
tell me why not.
Yeah. Because even if you test before and after, there's three different reasons. First, it's incredibly unfair to the teachers who live in a world I can't even envision, which is everybody comes to class prepared. Okay, you know, I can't even envision that world, so it's way out there somewhere. But in that case, you know, if everybody started the world, and this has happened, this did absolutely happen. And when the LA Times presented the value added measure of teachers, they had a teacher who's like, you're saying my kids went from average 97% to average 94%, and therefore I, you know, was a terrible teacher. You're like,
okay.
And then you've got, so there's that, which is tremendously unjust. But then you've got someone like me. So do I get more credit for moving the low ability kids? Do I get any credit at all for taking a kid who was at counting on their fingers to where that kid is factoring a quadratic, graphing a line, I'm trying to think what else, graphing a line, transforming functions, right?
Okay.
And, are you going to say, well, my test is up here, and the fact that the kid could do that thing, the difference between the kid who started the year and that kid on the score is three questions, you know, and so there's nothing there. And meanwhile, at the top end, it's absolutely true. It is absolutely true that you cannot constantly challenge in a high ability classroom, in a range ability classroom. You can't challenge everybody. So my top kids, my kids aren't like sitting around reading when they're done. I'm always giving them more challenges. But nonetheless, how do you square that needle?
Let me see if I understand. If you assess the teacher based on the change over the course of a year in the test scores that the students manifest, that's going to lead the teacher to bias her effort toward the kids at the bottom where she can raise the scores by the most, and that's not fair to the kids at the top. Is that what you
said? Yeah, it's actually, historically speaking, what we do, if it's a pass-fail test, is we focus on the kids in the middle. We ignore the kids.
Because you can't get the kids at the bottom above the pass line no matter what you do.
Exactly. So historically speaking, there's lots of evidence that shows that teacher focus on the kids in the middle to make sure they're over it.
So you don't like using test scores to assess teachers because it biases the way the teachers allocate their effort to helping the kids.
Also, I don't know if you've ever read, I don't know how to say his name, Kirabo Jackson. He does a lot of work showing, which again, and I probably believe this because it's, I forget what that is, where it confirmation bias. He's got a lot of work showing that the teachers who help the kids on metrics like attendance and engagement, that those efforts last longer than teachers who raise test scores. And I'm stating it badly. But in other words, and I absolutely believe that. I think we focus a little too much on proficient, yeah, advanced or everything else, as opposed to moving the needle. I call it moving the needle. Does that kid know more? Does that kid have more confidence in himself? By the way, this is a T. I always say, what is like one of the weakest things about an academic orientation as a teacher? The single biggest thing is there is no point to teaching this kid. You know, this kid's never going to get to calculus, so why are you even teaching him algebra 2? Why, you know, he needs 3 years for graduation and that. That's like, no. A kid who gets even half of algebra 2 is getting a sense in themselves,
yeah,
of I can do more than I thought I could do.
I'm stimulated by that. I like this very much, actually, because there are subtle points that are being made here about assessment and about incentives and about how you measure what you're trying to accomplish. Given that you have heterogeneity, that you have, yes, distribution of abilities, of preparedness and of interest across the school system, and the idea that I would have a single metric like, looking at the average amount of improvement in the test score of the class of kids as a measure of the teacher is deeply problematic for the reasons that you stated. And this thing that I like, I interpret it as like hard skills and soft skills, right? I'm trying to get them to factor the quadratic or whatever it is, solve the equation. But I also want to have them have a little bit more self-confidence. I want to have them have And this study that you mentioned by this name that you couldn't pronounce, but this seemed interesting to me. If the attenuation rate, you know, I raised the test score, but then it slides back down towards some mean, you know, versus if I can change behavior or self-confidence or, yeah, you know, whatever, that might have a much more long-lasting and beneficial consequence in the life of the child.
Let me give you an example. Yeah. Santino, that kid with the circles, yeah, okay? He scored below basic on his algebra test, okay? But he then went on and passed geometry too. Okay, this was a kid who was putting zero on his papers. I would have gotten no credit for what I did in those 2 years. You know, none whatsoever. It was, yeah, there's nothing that said, you know, in fact, many math teachers should say you should have failed in both years. And again, that's a legitimate difference. You know what I mean? There are math teachers who believe that if we were accurate in holding people to standards, that the pressure of all the failed kids would force a change in our expectations of what kids could get. And I get that. I do. I'm just like, the kids don't have a choice. And failing a kid, you have to understand, failing a kid who showed up every day for class and worked means that kid will not get credit for a year. They won't get credit. And so you're putting them on risk to not graduate. So I don't want to say that the teachers who say you should hold the standards are bad or evil. This is called the religious war. This is a constant debate among math teachers in this space that I live in, where you're constantly getting kids who are unprepared.
Okay, I want to, you know, we're talking about assessments, about standards. What about testing teachers? My understanding is that the movement to have teacher certification depend upon teachers passing some kind of standardized examination has swept the country, and that one consequence of that has been that a lot of Black, especially in Latino, prospective teachers are being rationed out of the system because they're unable to perform well enough on the state certification test. Is that true? A, is that true? And B, is that a bad thing?
A lot of people don't know this because there's this constant belief that teachers are, you know, three steps of mouth-breathing morons. it's true. I mean, you know, so high school teachers have had to pass a subject matter test since 1975, I think, that it was called the National Teachers Exam. So it's not new. Okay, high school teachers have always had to demonstrate a fairly high level of math ability, of subject matter ability. What happened was, and again, this was because of the degradation of the college degree over time, which was nobody ever bothered to test elementary school teachers because the assumption was from the time elementary school teachers from 1964 on, I think, had to have a college diploma. Nobody ever conceived of the notion that you could have a college diploma and not necessarily be able to read at the 10th grade level, do math at the 10th grade level, and everything else. Yeah. What happened was that stopped being true. And so in 1988, 89 is when the credential test happened and was starting to put on elementary school. And indeed, it wiped out African-American teachers. It was a huge, huge, just, you know, wipe out. And then what happened is in the 90s, because in this particularly happened in the South, that there was a desperate need for teachers, what you do is you get a college diploma and you get what's called an emergency credential. And the emergency credential would allow you to teach. And so people were teaching for years an emergency credential. And the No Child Left Behind in 2002 stopped that. And that again led to, you know, all these African-American teachers had to go back. It was mostly African-American and Hispanic teachers as this happened to. They had to go back to school. They had to, They had to go back and take a test to prove their competence level. And there was a lot of failures in that. And this is a constant tension. The guy who you want to read on this is a guy named Goldhaber, G-O-L-D-H-A-B-E-R. As you can tell, I'm terrible with last names. Dan Goldhaber. He's done research, and see, the thing is there is almost no research showing that smarter teachers get better outcomes. There is a depressing amount of research showing that black can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now, but will you repeat what there's a depressing amount of evidence of? Because you went blank there for a minute.
There's a depressing amount of evidence that black teachers do better with black kids. Particularly, in other words, teachers' race matters more than their test score.
And why is that depressing?
African American kids.
Why is that depressing?
Depressing because if you look at what we're doing, well, first off, it's depressing simply because it shows that race matters. I mean, you know, just in the overall scene, you know, it's like okay. You'd like to think that doesn't matter. But I have another reason. But the other thing I was going to say is, you know, going back to I teach versus kids versus subject. I wonder if African-American teachers have an easier time teaching African-American kids because the kids accept arguendo that the black teachers care about them. I've often wondered if
that's
maybe,
a plausible hypothesis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And yeah. So anyway, what I was going to say is, no, the other reason it's depressing is because you're seeing this constant tension. We need more and more and more smarter teachers when all the evidence says that doesn't seem to matter. Past the, you know, my guess is we're above there's a basement and we're above it. That's my guess.
Okay.
And so when you raise it, all you're doing is making it harder for African American and Hispanic teachers to become teachers. So I think I would actually argue we could create a special class for K-3, make that lower and get even more kids, more African Americans and Hispanics, but who are now like social workers. You know, to have them work in that environment and get even more teachers in there.
Where they're caring about the kids, or at least the kids knowing that they care about the kids, is more important than them knowing all the math because they're teaching at a very elementary level.
Exactly.
Am I following you?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, again, this is so interesting and subtle how you say it's depressing that the race of the teacher matters at some cosmic level. I guess I've been
close. Yeah, that's, I meant cosmically. Yeah.
On the other hand, if indeed it's the fact that the race of the kid matters, the teacher and the kid, then I want to know that. That's a very important piece of information for me figuring out how to get the kid educated, because that's the goal at the end of the day.
And remember, part of the pressure is that because there is this belief, the teachers are stupid. And particularly at the high school level, and I don't think it's out there enough that, like, for example, New York just famously took away one of their credential requirements, because it was disproportionately hurting black and Hispanic teachers. And so among the intelligentsia, like, see, you know, the teachers couldn't be smart enough, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, they didn't take away any subject matter requirements. You know what I mean? In other words, you still had to pass whatever high school level math test. This is only an additional test that they had because they kind of had this notion that they want their teachers to be erudite people who can talk in, you know, triple sentences. And it was killing some of their thing. And they're like, let's get rid of it. But people don't understand that high school teachers have to pass very demanding tests in their subjects.
Listen, I'm going to cut us off here because we're going on for over an hour.
Oh, it's been nice talking to you.
Wonderful to have your perspective on the problem of teaching. And I expect to be hearing more from you. I'll keep an eye out at Quillette.com if you're out there. Editors,
I haven't submitted it yet. I was joking. I just felt that they would, they say they publish anything. And I mean, it wouldn't be, I think by now you can tell, it wouldn't be some liberal complaint about the whole thing. It's just that I feel that they would, they tend not to have a good opinion of teachers is what I was saying.
I see. Well, they ought to give you the time of day. Watch your inbox at Quillette. Something's coming. Thanks, Michelle. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity. I had a great time. It was really nice to talk to you. It's kind of fun watching the Glenn show all these years to be the person here talking. And it's just like it feels when I'm watching it. It's great.
Oh, that's cool. I'm going to stop the tape.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits of Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.